you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime. And my second feature is written, and we'll begin that journey soon.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently in pre-production of my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep, and I used to work at Sundance. On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 263 from May 2020 with Greg Barker about moving from his career in documentaries to making his first narrative slash fiction feature for Netflix. Alric thought this was a good pairing for Stefan because both their first fiction features were produced by Netflix under very different circumstances and in different points in their careers. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, don't forget to check out our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/mmihpodcast is how we keep the show running. We would appreciate any dollars or cents you had to give us to keep doing this because we enjoy it. Make sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And without any further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Greg Barker.
In the documentary world, a lot of my friends, but I love the doc filmmakers, but people are so obsessed with awards, it distorts the whole process. And everyone starts, you know, playing everyone else, and you get all these emails about how, you know, come see my movie. And a lot of it's all a game, and it's kind of nauseating. And I mean, I'm a member of the Academy and all that, but I've not won an Oscar, and but sure, I would love to, but you know, if you just play for that, it's not why any of us got into this. We are lucky to be making movies, incredibly lucky and privileged. And let's remember why we actually do it, which is to tell stories that move people, not to win awards.
One of the main questions I had was like the origin of bringing the because he made a documentary about it in 2009 for HBO. And so I was like wondering, like, oh, out of all the documentaries that he's made, like, why was this one the one that he wanted to make into the feature? And he has a really fantastic story about that, which you'll hear.
Also, I think we press him a lot about not having a ton of fiction experience, but going into a first fiction feature. I actually have like 15 more questions for him that we didn't ask. But just the concept of like, we often all feel imposter syndrome, but like he has this confidence because it's about storytelling. You don't need to have like these mystical qualities to direct a fiction feature.
Because I don't think he had any fiction experience. I think it was only the feature, and that he was like his whole career before was either journalism or documentaries. And so to me, taking on a, you know, I'll just ruin it a little bit, a $16 million movie as your first feature, I mean, I would be terrified.
But then get into Sundance, right?
Yeah, he obviously didn't have that fear, and he had a lot of confidence, like you said. And it was interesting to hear his answers and like what he, some of the things that he did in his prep for it, and just the way he approached the film. And then I watched the movie beforehand, and it was very good.
As per usual, I did not watch the movie.
Before we get to Greg, let's get to the network. Liz, what do we have for this week?
So Jay DeBlas wrote an article that tied into the Tribeca premiere of this film that he's attached to called Not Going Quietly would have happened, you know, is set to happen in April.
Right.
And he wrote an article about that film and also the future of independent filmmaking in relation to COVID-19. But what I really wanted to say is that this movie's amazing. And it seems like this article is kind of a secret, stealthy promotion of the film Not Going Quietly. And I wish the whole article was about Not Going Quietly because it's a fantastic documentary about Adi Barkin. And it's so timely because Adi has ALS. And he's fighting for healthcare rights, and he's fighting for all these, you know, the concept of like being hit with a diagnosis of a disease that's debilitating and using your time and your resources incredibly wisely and efficiently. And this is turning into me criticizing JD Plus, but I just wanted to say everyone should see this movie if they can, when they can.
This article title from IndieWire is a little misleading because it says like J2PLUS has seen the future and it doesn't look so bad. And then you read the documentary and it's like he doesn't really have any like future insight. It's just that the simple fact that he's made low budget movies his whole career. And this writer is positing that, you know, when the quarantine is lifted, making movies in groups of 20 or under is going to be far more beneficial than making movies with bigger crews.
I have this feeling, maybe it's paranoia, I'm known to be a little bit tightly wound, but if so, we're set to shoot June 15th. We're nowhere near ready to shoot June 15th. We're not cast because no one wants to jump on board our film because they're like waiting for a scheduled pilot season. They're waiting to figure out big budget projects that they don't know if they're in line for. Like, there's a lot of questions in the air. So if our little indie production goes and starts shooting in June or July, when it still feels like studios are not necessarily going to be all gung-ho to be making projects, I feel like we're going to get the finger wag towards us. Because as an indie production, we're not going to be able to do, you know, antibody testing prior. We're not able to do these like 2-week quarantines that other studio producers are suggesting. Well, we're not going to be able to do this, you know. We're not going to have the actors put on their own makeup because, I mean, we're still going to be working with actors who are not used to putting on their own makeup. There's all these presumptions about what a production can do post-COVID-19. And I don't know if our little indie micro-budget feature can sustain that kind of behavior under our budget level, under our time constraints, all of these things. So I just think the idea that we've been prepared to do this because as indie filmmakers, we've worked in small groups and we've hustled like hell is very romantic. But I think we also have a lot of responsibility on our shoulders in protecting the safety and health of our cast and crew members. And that doesn't go away if you're a small production versus a large production.
Right, but if they're allowing people to meet in groups of 50 or under and, like, businesses are opening, let's say bars even open, you know, and gyms open or whatever, like, why can't an indie film crew go out and make a movie with a 20-person crew? Like, I don't understand what's the difference.
I guess maybe I just feel nervous about that burden of responsibility. So if we bring on a low budget crew member who says, oh yeah, I can. I'm totally healthy. Don't you worry about that, because they want a job, you know, fair, you know, and that's fair. Right. I mean, people have been not been able to work for a while. Then there's like this issue, this moral ambiguity of like, do you hire the people you can afford who say that they're healthy? You're trusting a lot, which I think is scary.
Right. Well, I think you also have to just, if you know your crews well, right, and you trust your crew of people, then you know they're not going to endanger everybody, you know, for whatever the tiny little day rate that we can afford on an indie production, you know.
But without testing, you don't know. You don't know if they are well. I don't know if I'm well. I don't know if my partner's well.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, you know, like we just made this movie in February and March that we finished right before the whole lockdown thing. And we have a big message group with all our, you know, the whole crew. And I mean, I basically trust every single one of those people. Like if they were to tell me, oh, yes, like I can come out and do this pickup day that we have to do, hopefully also in June, like I wouldn't have a second thought about that. I would obviously, you know, we're going to wear gloves. We're going to wear masks. We're going to follow all these safety procedures that people think that we should be doing that we're all talking about. But I'm not going to not do it because I'm worried that someone's lying to me, you know, because I trust them. And if they do that, then, I mean, we'll have to deal with it. But I'm just trusting that people won't, you know.
Yeah, but you already know them. Like, I'm starting a production where I've actually very specifically asked not to produce this project. I don't have the bandwidth.
Oh, right.
So I'm not overseeing hires.
Right. So you don't know the people.
Yeah, I don't know these. And like, I know our DP. I know our production designer. I trust them, like, absolutely. Like you, I've worked with them. I trust them. I love them. But, you know, if they're being forced under a budget constraints to bring in teammates that they've never worked with before, I think that's where it gets a little scary. So I'm with you. Right. Like if you have a team that you've worked with, that you've been in the trenches with, that's different. You have a common language. But if you're bringing in crew members, who will work for your budget level, which is sometimes a little bit of a gamble.
Yeah, true.
I think that there's fear for me there. So I think, and we have a production meeting in a few hours, so we'll probably talk about it then.
Oh, nice. Yeah, well, I'm curious to hear what you guys decide and how you decide to move forward, you know. And I mean, as the director, like, you don't really have to come in contact with that many people necessarily. Like, you basically just need to talk to your cinematographer and your AD and then your producer. And then probably maybe, and they're actors, obviously, but not really anyone else, you know, like, you don't have to be talking to every single person.
Well, I'm not worried about me, actually. I'm worried about
cast, other people,
actually, the cast, which is horrible to say. I should say that I'm worried about everyone. And I realize now that I came in a little hot and my opinion is a little bit more tempered than it appeared at the beginning of this conversation. Right. But for me, it's like, you can't replace an actor once you start shooting. I mean, you can. There are instances we refer to them when we in our show with Leah McKendrick, but for the most part they're irreplaceable in my eyes, and if they get sick, then what do we do? We waste a lot of money.
I mean, I had a sick actor on the alternate, unfortunately, because, like, the whole crew was kind of sick, you know, while we were making it, just because of the time of the year, and I was really sick too. And we got through it, and I'm watching the scenes now where he was really sick, and, you know, you can kind of tell a little bit, but he really did a good job of pulling it together. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think it's just one of those things. It's like a risk you always have to take, you know, COVID-19 or not. I think my point about this article is, yeah, I think you're right. It's mostly just a cover for promotion for this film. But it's a good film, so, you know, hey, I think read the article and see what you think. But I think it's... Yeah, JD Plus doesn't really add his comments, darling. He had any, like, secret, you know, opening the box of, like, how to shoot movies when this all goes. There's nothing special in there.
I hope we can pivot to make this happen.
I think we have to. We've got to make stuff. Like, I'm talking to a writer about collaborating on a project, hopefully in July or August, that I'm going to adapt one of her plays into a script and hopefully direct it. And I think if we do it with a crew of 5 to 10 people, it's like, let's just, I mean, I feel like I want to make stuff just to prove to the world that we can still make stuff, you know, and that, like, that this it's not the end. Like, I feel like I talk to a lot of my more pessimistic friends and they're, like, very down right now. And they think, like, oh, it's going to be September before, like, we're going to get locked down until September, or we're going to, you know, all this other stuff. And I mean, who knows what's going to happen? But, like, I think the world's going to keep turning and we're going to keep making movies and we're going to all go back to our jobs, you know, one point or another. And we just got to hang in there, man, you know? But be safe.
I think there's a world, just to cap off my perspective, where if you're non-union and not using SAG talent and you're still respecting, obviously, and treating your crew members and cast members well and not abusing them because you're going full non-union, where you could make it work. You could. I think it's the unions that are rightfully protecting their members that are going to slow down production timelines, you know, most likely for the best. But if you are able to be nimble and work outside of a union setting and you want to do that and your actors want to do that, then I do think there's a way to keep making content.
I wonder if SAG is going to let actors go onto set when this is over, what SAG's reaction is going to be.
That's, like, the main thing I'm thinking about is, like, attaching talent in this moment.
But guess what, Liz?
What?
You've got mail.
What?
Pretty old mail, but I wanted to read these emails because they started way back in 2019 and then they kept on going. So it's sort of interesting, this series of emails from this filmmaker listener.
Hello, my name is Colton Yerquahart, and I'm a 13-year-old filmmaker from Fallon, Nevada. I'm a huge fan of your show, and between your podcast and Film Riot? I've gathered almost all the knowledge that I have about filmmaking. Oh, I've been working on a feature film for just over a year now. Pause. Let's just recap. This is a 13-year-old working on a feature who has gathered lots of knowledge about filmmaking.
Yeah.
We should just appreciate that.
They've learned how to make a film from listening to podcasts and watching YouTube videos. So this is commendable by itself.
So this person's finished shooting. most likely, they say, and just released a trailer and a teaser a couple of weeks ago. Oh my God, I don't even think I knew that you were supposed to release trailers and teasers until I was 25. right. My teaser and trailer are both playing in front of movies and theaters all over Northern Nevada. Holy crap. But I haven't been able to get a good review of my progress quality of this production from a fellow filmmaker. My movie is called The Legion of Hope, and it will most likely have a theatrical release on November 1st. Hello. I'm hoping that people can differentiate my comments from this letter. I really hope you can review my trailer teaser and give me some feedback on what you think I should do, or just review a review on my trailer. Thank you so much for your time. I'll leave links below. This is crazy. This is amazing. This is a hero filmmaker, 13 years old.
So Timothy and I both watched the trailer and gave detailed notes. Timothy gave more detailed notes than I did. And, you know, Timothy wasn't even on the podcast at this time anymore, but he still gets the email. So he just, you know, wanted to chime in and reach out to this, this filmmaker. And I don't think I think he responded first because I was very busy. And then I responded second, you know, like a jerk. But anyways, and then, so this is another email he sent. This is probably, I think, January, like, 2020. So this is, like, pretty recent. And this was after we had given him feedback and, like, his response to our feedback and, like, kind of an update on where he is now. So, hello again. I'm Carlton Urich Hart. You said it better than me. From a few months ago with the Legion of Hope. And after months of reshoots and editing, I am finally finished it. And I'm playing it in my local theaters on Friday. But anyways, I took your advice on the trailer advertisement work. And I think hope that this one is a lot better than my first couple. If you give me some feedback on this one, then I would really appreciate it. Because I haven't yet had someone that's not part of my family review the VFX. And just general wellness of the trailer. Here's the link. P.S. I found the latest episode of Making Movies is Hard, the one with your voice memos, all Rick's voice memos, very inspiring and satisfying knowing that there's other people out there that are still having problems even with a crew and money, so I know I'm not alone. You can probably imagine how many problems I have shooting a feature on my iPhone in 4K. Thanks and best of luck with the alternate. I'm really excited to see it.
I love that he thinks 4K is a problem. Like, oh, 4K.
Well, shooting it on an iPhone is like, you know, it is. It's, I mean, having made my own iPhone short film last year, 2 years ago. I can't remember. Maybe it was just last year. I know the pain. It's definitely a challenge. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was just a really wonderful series of emails. And I believe I wrote back to him after that one. And I can't remember if I've heard from him. Who knows if Colton's still listening, but I just wanted to read these emails on air for Colton, just so people can hear that like 13 year olds are making feature films on their iPhones. And I'll have to say, like, it looks far better than anything I made until I was like, I don't know, 25.
Yeah.
Like the things I was making, I made something when I was 16, I think was the first thing I ever made. And his work is way more impressive. I mean, he's got drone work in it. He's got dolly work in it. It looks really impressive. He's in Nevada, so he's got all this amazing desert locale, and he really utilized the desert around where he lives to really make the production value look like Lawrence of Arabia in some certain scenes. And it was really impressive. And he got older people to be in the movie, so it's not just a bunch of kids, which really helps make it feel more legit. So good on you, Colton.
Colton, great job. We're like excited that you exist.
And, you know, I'm going to go ahead and do some homework and try to find the links to Colton's work. And at least we'll have the trailer, if not the full film, on the show notes so people can see what Colton has come up with. Because, yeah, I think it's pretty impressive that you just go out there. And I mean, and Colton's not the only one. There's lots of other filmmakers who started really young and have made features before they're 18. And I think it's great. And, you know, I'm a little jealous, but yeah, you know, good on you. I could have made a feature when I was 18.
I mean, absolutely. But I think let's open it up too. I mean, if you're 65 and you're doing your first feature as well, and you want someone to look at your trailer and you're not sure who to ask, I don't want to open the doors to give you more work. All right.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're happy to take a look at some of these things from time to time.
And I think Liz will actually watch one of these too, maybe.
Yeah, probably.
Right?
Yeah, it's a trailer. It's short. I could do that.
I think if someone sent a trailer in now, I think Liz would watch it. Whether you be 12 or 90, I think we would gladly watch it. And we actually have some, you know, I don't want to say older gentlemen guests coming on soon, but yeah, we did talk to some filmmakers who made their first film in their 60s, I believe. That's going to be exciting to hear that story. So what do you got for us this week, Liz?
So this is more of a call to action.
Ah.
Let's say you're pitching to an investor and they're asking for projections. And you are like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to pull from really successful indie comedies because my film's an indie comedy. And I'm going to pull in Napoleon Dynamite because that made a lot of money because it was very low budget. And, you know, it's a great projection for an investor because it shows we'll be really successful. What I want to just kind of express is that, first of all, Napoleon Dynamite was like 1,000 years ago in movie terms, and it's when people were going to the movies and when nothing like Napoleon Dynamite had come out, and it was when Sundance had less competition because there were less entries. You know, there's all these different reasons what that made Napoleon Dynamite an outlier. And the reason I'm bringing all this up is because when you're thinking about marketing and distribution or financing, everyone has to pull from very recent data. And so this is a call to action to refer to recent data when you're talking to investors, because if not, you're kind of pulling the rug, the wool over their eyes a little bit. You're making suggestions and commitments of success that are fairly unlikely if you're comparing them to marketplace 20 years ago. But also, this is a call to action for filmmakers to share their data, because the reason we pull from things like Napoleon Dynamite is because we have very little micro budget success stories and data from those success stories to share with investors and producers in order to get people to jump on board our projects. And so I wanted to promote a few things. Just a few days ago, this amazing resource was published, and it's on behalf of the Film Collaborative, which is, they do like festival repping, they help with distribution, they consult, they're just really an amazing, amazing company. And they published about 10 case studies of filmmakers who are willing to talk very openly and specifically and granularly about how they made their film and how they released it. That's call to action, is be like these filmmakers, be brave, be transparent, share your information. And then call to action is read these case studies on the Film Collaborative website. They are astounding. I wanted to do a late plug for the Sundance case studies. We did 2 case studies a few years ago for Columbus and Unrest. And in a few months, we should, you know, my teammate Jess should be publishing ones for Thunder Road, The Devil We Know, and 306 Hollywood. So read the data out there, share your data, and then come on the show and tell us about how you spent your money and what worked for you. An additional plug for Tom Huang, who's on the show talking about Find Me, and his case study is up there, and it is amazing.
Yeah, I have some thoughts about all this stuff. I mean, it's interesting, the whole comparison thing and like what you put in your materials. Because I mean, when I first started my deck, I put all kinds of like fancy famous movies in there. And I think some of the advice I got was similar to what you said. We're like, don't put like the outliers in there. Don't put the Get Outs of the world in your thing, because that's not helpful. Like, your movie's not going to do what Get Out did. Your movie's not going to do, like you said, like what Napoleon Dynamite did. Like, it's just not the same, right? Yeah. You know, no matter how much you think it is, it's not.
And it's old.
It's a different time.
Just a few years ago, it's old somehow.
Yeah. So you have to pick things that are like within at least a 5-year period of when you're making your movie, you know. And I had movies like Spring, I thought was a really good example because it was a really low budget movie that, you know, got distribution and did well. I think it was made for somewhere around 500, and then it grossed like I think a couple million. You know, J.D. Dillard's movie was a good example at the same time, because that was like, yeah, Slight. It was like $250,000 budget, and it did a couple million or something, or I think 1.7 was its box office, you know, which was like really great, you know, numbers for a $250,000 movie.
Yeah.
So those were sort of some of the examples that I went to, and I took off like the big, like being John Malkovich and all these other things that like they just don't relate to my movie. Like, no matter how much I think they're similar, it's like they have movie stars. They are directed by famous people. They came out, you know, 20 years ago. Like, it's like all those things don't matter, like make it not a relevant comparison. So
those could be tonal comparisons. You could say it's like got the tone of
the tone. Exactly. And I think that's what I was thinking. I was like confusing tone with numbers.
Yeah.
In the beginning. And then I got smart to like, okay, like let's like actually pick movies that are like your movie. Like budget wise, size wise, and scope wise. Mm-hmm. You know, and then also, yeah, I think the timeliness thing is very important, especially now where things are just changing over and over and over again. So here is what Phantasm. I'm trying to say.
It's going to change. Someone's going to change that name. But Phantasm. I like Phantasm.
I love it.
It's a great movie. So, Phantasm's so fun.
Yeah. Is that Reggie Bannister?
Yeah. Reggie's in the movie. Yeah. Reggie's in the movie. Yeah.
I met Reggie Bannister at Comic-Con, and I had not seen any of the Phantasm movies at the time, and then we got his autograph, and he's like, so what Phantasm movie is your favorite? Is it 3? Is it 2? Is it 4? What's your favorite here?
First of all, it's 1, and...
Yeah. So Liz, the player. Who's our player for the week?
We have 2 players.
Yes.
Yay. The show.
The show.
Interviewed.
The show.
We created a prompt this week based off of how do you choose, why do you choose the projects that you do? Why do you jump on projects as an actress, as a producer, as a director? And both Bianca Beirutti and Christine Weatherup were interviewed, and here they are.
My name is Bianca Beirutti, and I'm an independent producer of both narrative and documentary film based in San Francisco. There are several factors that I consider when deciding whether or not to come onto a film as a producer. The first one is, you know, is the filmmaker's story or idea innovative or putting a refreshing twist on a familiar concept. Those are the kinds of movies that I like to watch, and therefore the ones I like to make as well. Another factor is, you know, what are my skills relative to the filmmaker's needs? Is it a chance for me to gain a new skill or learn something new? Or is it a chance to offer skills or support that the filmmaker doesn't have but needs, like around casting or crowdfunding? Another big thing for me is, you know, who's making the film? Is the writer or director or other team members, are they people that I respect and want to work with? Are there other women and people of color and queer folks on the team? Having diversity and a feeling of an inclusive production is really important to me.
I'm Christine Weatherup, and I am an actor, writer, and director. I think it can be any number of things that excite me as an actor. I think one of the first most important things is the filmmaker. I want to make sure that it's somebody I want to spend weeks on end with, and somebody that's a collaborator, somebody who's enthusiastic and has a vision. Those are all things that are important to me. I think the material is also quite important. I mean, if you really believe in that filmmaker, sometimes material that might not jump out at you on the first read is transformed once you talk to them. I think the other thing that also often is a deciding factor is, does the project challenge me? Is it something different than I've gotten the chance to do? Those things would definitely increase the chances of me saying yes. And do I just want to work with you?
Christine was in Westworld.
Yes.
Watchmen. Oh, and Westworld.
She was in both Westworld and Watchmen and Bread and Butter and Grey's Anatomy and Mad Men. And she's, and like some Rob Zombie movie that I don't know the name of, but I should because I'm a horror fan. Anyway, she's great. She's best.
And she's got her first feature that she's directing and I believe starring in that she's working on right now. So yeah. I'm sure we'll be getting to see that soon. But I remember when I watched Watchmen, I was like, because she's in the very opening of the show, I was like, yeah, wait, that looks like Christine. It's Christine!
She's amazing.
I was like, oh my God. And I texted Matt like right after, or I tweeted to both of them. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
I died. So I died cool. Because I'm like, I'm Chrissy's biggest fan. I just like absolutely adore her. And she nailed it in that. Like, I just felt like everyone should just like snatch her up and cast her in every single thing and have her direct every single thing.
And talk about the perfect, like, featured role in a show like that, where she not only got to, like, have, like, you know, a big portion of the show, but she got to do all these different emotional things in her scenes. Like, she got to show a nice range of stuff, because there's so many different snippets that you see. It is really awesome. I'm just a huge fan of that show. I thought that show was, like, flawless all the way through.
But I stopped watching after her episode.
What? Oh my God. It just gets better and better and better.
No, it's like, I just kept thinking, better. I'm not going to be more excited than seeing Chrissy on Watchmen. It's on our DVR. Every day Sean's like, Watchmen? And I'm just like, why? If Chrissy's not going to be in it, I don't really want to watch it.
It's so good. Oh my God. If Sean's not watching it because that you don't want to watch it, I feel bad for Sean. And I feel very bad for you too, because... Oh man, like you think that it's like got like it can't get any better as far as like episodes go, because like there is like a really amazing work of art episode. I think episode 7 or 8 is like, it's like a work of art. It is art.
Fine.
It is excellent art. And then where it goes from there in the last 2 or 3 episodes, it's like, it's just incredible. Okay. So
you told me to watch Hard Target. I watched Hard Target. You're telling me to watch this. We'll watch this. We're going to watch it. We'll probably start today. Thanks a lot. Whatever.
Sounds like you didn't really like Hard Target that much. You kind of liked Hard Target.
It's okay. I mean, it was actually really... anything that's dark, I can't watch. So it got really dark for me because of all murder.
Yes. There's a lot of murder in that movie.
I mean, quarantine depression is no joke, let me tell you. Ugh.
Well, here's one thing that you could do in the quarantine that might make you feel better, is you could go to our Patreon page.
What a great segue.
See what we have to offer over there, which is pretty much nothing but the show. But hopefully that might be enough. I don't know. We were working on swag. We are working on all kinds of things. It's all kind of come to a bleeding halt. Any kind of support you guys want to give on the show would be amazing. $1, $2, nothing, whatever.
$1 million. Let's start out there. $1 million. It's an option.
Let's just start out there. Yeah. But in an ongoing thank you to our continued support from our patrons. We love you. Thank you so much for supporting the show.
Thank you.
It means a lot to us. But if you don't have $1 or $100 or $1 million to support us on Patreon, you can go to iTunes and write us a review or just give us a rating. Either one would be great. Those are just as helpful as Patreon supporters.
Or you can email us at podcast@makingmoviesishard.com.
Without further ado, I think it's time to get to our conversation with Greg Barker. Greg, thank you so much for joining us today. We start the show with a little stat sheet, so to say, like a little breakdown of the film, and you know, just to get some of the general information out. So this is for Sergio. How many days did you shoot the film?
38.
Amazing. What was the rough budget?
About 16 million, which included some tax breaks and things like that in some of the countries.
And then how long did you work on it from its inception to the release? It
depends on what you mean by its inception. On one hand, I've been working on it since 2005 when I first came across the story. From the first time we pitched the specific idea to Netflix, it was about 2.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so pretty quick, actually.
At what point did you know that you wanted to do a narrative version of the documentary that you made?
Before I did the documentary.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I always saw it as a narrative feature, going back to the first time I encountered the kind of the outline of the details of the story, which happened because Samantha Power, who at the time was a professor at Harvard and who I knew, was writing a book about Sergio. And I started reading early chapters and saw it as a narrative feature. But at the time I was, you know, making films for Frontline for PBS. And so I was not going to realistically get a movie made. And so I did it as a feature documentary first. But then I always in the back of my head, I wanted to make it as a movie.
How many people were on set?
It went from a minimum of about 70 or 80 to about 450 on the bigger days.
Oh, wow. Holy moly. Yeah. And then out of all the projects that you've made in your career, how difficult was this one?
That's hard to say. It was challenging. It actually was also sort of charmed in that we didn't run into any number of massive challenges that we could have. I mean, we didn't have weather delays. We didn't have, you know, those kinds of things that can really, and we filmed on three continents. So, you know, everything kind of worked pretty smoothly. So, but at the same time, it was a big feature film compared to anything else I'd done before. So that was, it had its own challenges, but it was a pretty charmed project from the outset in that we didn't, it kind of went pretty smoothly.
I'm really inspired by what you said about knowing that you wanted to make a fiction version of this story. And well, can you talk a little bit about what convinced you and why you felt it needed to be told in that way?
There was a scope to this guy's life. Sergio Vieira de Mello was a, you know, it was a Brazilian diplomat for the United Nations. So sounds kind of dry, but actually he probably saw more war and human suffering than anybody of his generation. He just because of the scope of his career, stretching from Mozambique to Bangladesh to Cambodia, Rwanda, Iraq. And he somehow he remained an optimist throughout. A lot of people with those that kind of background become very cynical and jaded, which I know firsthand, having kind of early in my career working in that world as a journalist. So he saw the world very clearly and was able to act effectively politically in this world and remain optimistic. However, he could not see himself clearly. He was led a very chaotic personal life. Wasn't always as authentic as, you know, he would like to have been with those closest to him. So in that kind of internal struggle, I kind of identified with on a certain level. And I also saw that it had the kind of emotional and narrative scope of some of my favorite movies, like Year of Living Dangerously or The English Patient. And so I just saw it in that way from the very beginning. And you know, at the initially, Samantha Power had given the narrative rights to her book to somebody else before I started having this conversation. And so I got the documentary rights, carved those out. And then over time, this other filmmaker was not able to get his project off the ground. And I then got the narrative rights too. And, but it was a long project, but it really kind of ended up pretty much where I thought it was going to be from the very beginning.
Why were you able to make it in 2018 versus like 2012 or 2015? Was it just a certain like thing that happened that allowed you to pitch Netflix or take it out or get the script written, or what were the circumstances that allowed you to make the film?
Yeah, I mean, I think 10 years ago, a movie version at that time would have felt kind of like another Iraq war film because part of it's set in Iraq. And those films, as you recall, weren't doing very well. I mean, probably it's hard to recall the Iraq war movies of 2008, 2009, 2010, because they all tanked. But then also what happened was, you know, on a purely business practical level, which really matters, Wagner Moura, who plays Sergio, was coming off of playing Pablo Escobar in Narcos, the big Netflix series. And he is Brazilian. And totally independently, he was looking around for, you know, a new project. And he and his manager, who became one of the producers of the project, thought maybe he should play Sergio de Mello. And Wagner had a long time interest in human rights and the United Nations. So he started like thinking that maybe that was, you know, just, he would start doing his own research. And then we kind of just found out about each other. And he had already been at the top of my list to play Sergio. And so very quickly, we kind of got together and had long conversations on Skype and realized that we wanted to make the same movie. And then we were able to package that and find a great screenwriter and then took it as a pitch to Netflix. And so I had the rights to the book. Wagner was perfect for the lead. We kind of, the timing was right. And things just kind of, you know, sometimes happens, you know, it takes a while for the stars to align. And then when they do, things kind of take on their own momentum. I think now is the time for this movie. So having, you know, it kind of all worked out the way I think it, you know, it for the best, that this story at this moment is more relevant now, and we'll think we'll find a wider audience now than it would have done 10 years ago.
I'm also just thinking of like the learning lesson for filmmakers who are trying to attach talent. How did Wagner track you down, or how do you track? I mean, like, you found out about each other, but like, was it through your representation or was it through his? I mean, can you talk a little bit more about how you found each other?
I had the rights to this book, and so, you know, that had taken, I'd had them for years. Going back to 2011, I'd renewed them. I was doing other stuff. It wasn't always, the what I was doing full time, you know. But I at one point, I almost let the rights go. And I thought, I'll keep them, you know. Every time that costs money, that's money out the door that you get back in theory if the movie gets made, but, you know, that wasn't happening. And it wasn't an active development. Somebody on his side sent a message to Samantha Power's office. And at the time, she had gone on to be ambassador to the United Nations for Obama. And we were still in touch because I was making a film about the last year of the Obama administration for HBO. She just passed it on to me, and then we linked up. But the key thing that is important for any aspiring filmmaker is that, you know, I had the rights. You know, I had something. Otherwise, you know, it's very easy. And Wagner, there was never any sort of desire to kind of find another filmmaker. But, you know, if you don't have leverage as you're starting out, it gets much easier for somebody to say along the way, hey, let's get a filmmaker who's done XYZ or made movies like this before. And I had that one card in my hand. It's not an automatic ticket to get to make the movie, but it got me into the conversation. And then I had to prove myself from there and then got to make the film.
Were there any concerns about you directing, you know, such a big budget film as your first film coming from a world of documentary filmmaking? Or were people pretty confident that you were going to have the chops to lead the ship on this?
I mean, I was confident. I'm sure there were doubts. They never really were expressed to me directly. I mean, I never had that conversation with Wagner. Often you have to go in and we have a pitch meeting, and then I had to go in, which I wanted to do separately, and my directorial vision for the film. So I had a big deck that my producers, you know, helped me put together because I hadn't done one of these before. But it was actually really helpful. And it's like everything from tonally, how it'll feel, what the look of it is, prospective cinematographers, you know, just the whole sort of take on what my director's vision was, and prospective cast beyond Wagner. And it kind of worked, you know, it was a very useful exercise to go through. It took quite a lot of work, but it then meant that when I went in to have that meeting, I knew exactly the film that I wanted to make. And looking back on it, which I did actually just recently, it's pretty damn close. When a studio is hiring a director or a director to be like the captain of a ship, because you just go off into the world, the director has a huge amount of autonomy and authority, and things can go off the rails really quickly. And it's very hard to change course. So they have to have confidence, rightly so, that you know what you're doing and you have a clear vision that you can communicate to people. So, you know, I'm sure there were questions, but I never, ever felt any doubt because I was able to show that I had a clear view of the direction I want to take the film.
You know, you did the documentary and now you're doing the fiction film. That's a lot of years of Sergio, but also it's a lot of pressure because you're defining and redefining a character in different ways. And I guess I wanted to know just a little bit more of, did you feel a sense of responsibility in conveying all aspects of his character? Did you feel worried? Were you threatened? Were you scared at that pressure, or did you feel like you had, you know, all the research you needed from the documentary, and so it did you kind of let go a little bit for the fiction film to see what life could come to itself?
Yeah, it's more like that, and it's the same in documentaries. It's like feeling pressure to tell a certain story in a certain way is actually not productive, because then that inhibits you. You know, you have to feel free on the set, whether that's with, you know, 400 extras or just a very sort of emotional one-on-one interview for a documentary. You have to feel free in the edit room. It's just you have to let go. Now, all the preparation is absolutely crucial, because it's only by immersing at least for me, immersing myself in that, in the subject, that I then know it so well inside and out that then I'm free to relax and kind of, you know what's going to work and what doesn't work. So treating the subject the second time, honestly, it sounds a little weird, but it's true. It felt like somebody else had made the documentary. By the time I got to making the movie, it was so different emotionally. It was a completely different kind of movie. And I didn't even watch the doc. I didn't even want to go back to it at all. It was almost like I'd done a huge amount of research, and that was great. So the prep had all been done. I had to dive back into that. As a filmmaker, I didn't care what I had done the first time because it wasn't productive. It felt like a totally different experience. And I think it had to feel that way. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to do it. I mean, I have no interest in repeating myself. But it was, you know, it saved a huge amount of time because I knew the world inside and out and was able to convey that to the crew and the cast. And also, I mean, luckily, I kept all the research. So I had all this material, both from rushes to all this archival materials, which were amazing references for the production design and costume, and also for the cast too. So, you know, that was great, but it felt very like a totally different film.
Can you talk a little bit about structuring the film and how you approached like getting the film written and everything? Like, did you seek out a writer to be brought onto the project and kind of hire them and work with them closely? Or like, just talk to us about how that structure and the story that we see in this film like kind of came together.
Yeah, I mean, well, Craig Borton, who wrote Dallas Buyers Club, was he kind of also came to the material sort of organically. I think I can't remember how he first came across it. He and Wagner are both at UTA, and so I think he just saw it as a possible project on these lists that go around and was drawn to it. We all kind of saw the movie in a similar way, as kind of a man grappling with the choices he'd made in the course of his life as he's struggling to survive. On a practical level, it's like, you know, I thought about the structure of the story a lot over the years. I mean, Sergio had led such a kind of epic life and had loved and failed and fallen out of love so frequently. There was a lot of story there, which is great in a book, but, you know, obviously a lot of choices have to be made in a movie. So we kind of, you know, for a lot of reasons, a lot of practical reasons, a lot of just narrative reasons, we chose this kind of nonlinear structure, which I think suits the material. But also, you know, the linear structure of his story would have been a $60, $70 million movie, right? It's just so, right. I'm not sure it would have been any better. But you then actually have to be in each place for a long time. If you have a structure where basically it's all taking place inside somebody's head as they're, you know, so Sergio is the target of a terrorist attack on the UN headquarters in Baghdad shortly after the American invasion. And he's trapped in the rubble with another guy, and two US medics are trying to save him. And in the course of that drama inside the rubble, which in real time lasts about 90 minutes, he's having lots of interactions with the rescuers, with people outside, including his fiance, and thinking about the choices he's led along, both professional and personal, that have brought him to that moment. So it's a very kind of fluid structure. But that also means filmically that you can remember flashes. You know, you can remember, you know, a moment from a scene in East Timor, in say Cambodia, where if you did it in a linear fashion, you'd have to then be in Cambodia. What's that mission about? What's this? You'd have to develop all of it, which would take longer to shoot. But we were also able to kind of distill each moment in his life to its absolute essence. It actually helped production-wise, but I think it also made a more kind of poetic, I hope, a more poetic telling of the story. So there were lots of factors that went into that, but I think in the end, it's again, that's kind of the way I saw the story from the very beginning.
I just wanted to ask about the romantic arc in the film, because that ends up being like a pretty big part of the story.
Yes.
And I haven't seen the documentary, so I don't know if that's a big part of the documentary as well. But I'm just curious, like, you know, why did you settle on that being integral to the story, and kind of how did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, again, I saw it as key from the outset. And Ana de Armas, who's incredible, plays Sergio's, you know, life partner, Carolina Larriera, who was with him in Baghdad when the bomb goes off, literally down the hallway. and is trying to find him. And then in real life actually goes up to the rubble where he's, you know, which you can kind of speak to him through this kind of hole in the rubble. It's incredibly dramatic. And it is, you know, featured in the documentary too. But I just felt like, you know, Sergio, there's a political version of this that just kind of focuses on the UN and the US, and that's interesting. But for me, that's more of like the kind of films I would have made for Frontline for PBS, or, you know, you can write a book about all that. I was really interested in this struggle of a man who'd been everywhere and saw the world sort of so clearly, but couldn't see himself. And then through this relationship has this transformative experience where he then starts seeing his professional work more clearly and seeing himself by being challenged by this very, very strong economist from within the UN system who basically calls him out on a lot of his bullshit, and both professional and personal, and challenges him to become a more complete human being. And he pushes away from that and is scared of that and scared of the intimacy that would involve, but realizes that his life has kind of been, you know, only, you know, kind of half full. And so I've always thought, and then Carolina is, you know, there when this most dramatic moment in his life unfolds. So it, for me, it was just a natural way of unpacking that story. But I also felt like, I'm more and more interested in the emotional stories of characters rather than, like, you know, the politics. I come from a, you know, political world, and I've covered a lot of, you know, political events. But I also think what drives the human experience is our deep emotions and how we're tested in moments of crises. And for me, that comes through. I thought, you know, what would you be thinking about when you're stuck in the rubble? You're not going to be thinking about a UN Security Council resolution. You're going to think about, you know, who you fell in love with and the choices you made. Exactly. That kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I thought it worked perfectly for that because, you know, it just felt natural that that's where his mind would go. And I never felt distracted by any of the times that we flashed around because it all kind of came together to tell a really fluid story in the end, you know. But I had one very specific, and I know Liz hasn't had a chance to see the movie. So, you know, I'm sorry, Liz, but I have to ask a very specific question.
Yes.
Cause this is the part where that really got to me, but it's this scene in this loom shop in Timor, I believe it is. Can you talk about where you came up with that scene? Like how that was born and kind of how you approached that scene? Cause that was incredible. And that was one of the times where it brought tears to my eyes watching the film because it was so powerful. But I just want to hear about that.
I mean, this is actually, I'm glad you mentioned this because it's, we actually, Wagner and I did a little piece on Instagram or Twitter for Netflix called Shot by Shot, where we go through that scene. It was just posted yesterday. So you should
excellent.
Check it out.
Yeah,
listeners,
I'd love
check
to see
it out because so Sergio, it's like he's in East Timor where he's incredibly powerful. He's in fact the most powerful official in UN history for a particular country where he's running this entire country, which is trying to establish itself as an independent nation from its neighbor, Indonesia. But things are not going well. He's got incredible power, but he can't get the rebel leader who's led this independence movement to give him the time of day. And he's sort of lost. He's wandering through this village and he meets Carolina, who he had encountered briefly at at a reception. And she is just walking down the street and she takes him to a weaving hut where she's running a microfinance project for Timorese women who are, you know, kind of building, trying to rebuild their country from the ground up by just, you know, making fabrics and things. And he has this incredible conversation with one of the weavers there. Her name is Senorina, where she talks about, he asks her about what she wants for the future. And she tells this incredibly poetic story about wanting to go back to her homeland and go up to the, you know, go up into the sky and become a cloud and fall like rain on the land where she was born. And It's an amazing story. So this actually happened to Sergio, not exactly in East Timor. It happened in a refugee camp in Central Asia. He was on some UN fact-finding mission and being shepherded around by, you know, all of these top officials. And, you know, I've seen these things, you know, where usually these, you know, dudes in suits march past, you know, people who are completely destitute and kind of pretend to care, but really, you know, and often do good work, but they're not really engaging with people. Sergio, that wasn't his style, you know, ever. But there was this one moment where he ended up in a conversation with a refugee woman who had lost everything and told her this story almost verbatim to what you have in the, you know, what we have in the movie. And in this, in Samantha Power's book. And I just thought, you know, initially it wasn't in the script, actually, because it was kind of like, well, how do we, would it be too corny? And Wagner and I were just going through stuff as we were preparing for final shooting. I was like, this is an amazing moment. We got to figure out a way of doing it. And so we, you know, we constructed this, you know, we made it work for that scene. And you know, it was really, for something like that to work, it has to feel authentic. So the woman in the movie who, you know, delivers that line is not an actress. She and everyone else in that we've had are from East Timor. We filmed the scene in Thailand because it's kind of logistically impossible to film in East Timor. But we flew a few dozen extras and sort of, you know, minor characters in from East Timor, plus all the textiles and costumes and everything to kind of recreate East Timor in rural Thailand. So, and that, those lines, yes, they're pretty much what was said to Sergio in a refugee camp in Asia. However, the woman saying them really lost all of her family in the independence struggle. So she felt like they were coming from her own experience, that she was speaking for herself and for her entire country. So we didn't rehearse that scene. You could feel the pent up emotion, and in Signorina herself, and we need to capture this. So we filmed that, you know, really for the first time that anyone even said the lines. So that reaction that you see where Sergio is so taken aback and moved and hugs her, that all just happened. None of that was really anticipated. Wow. It just happened. Wagner's just reacting to this woman's very real emotion, and he had his very genuine reaction to that. So, and it's a transformative moment for Sergio in the movie. So if it doesn't work right, we're kind of screwed for the rest of the film. And then, you know, he then sees himself differently. He sees Carolina differently. The next scene, they kiss, and, you know, and he changes his whole approach to how he's dealing with the political situation in his team, or it's a key moment. And it was either going to work or not. And so all of that stuff, trying to make it authentic by drawing on what really happened, by this amazing sort of performance by this real, you know, person who is not acting. Well, she is acting, but she's drawing from her own experience, made it all kind of work. So I'm glad that you picked that out.
I've been chewing on this question, and I feel like you just teed up almost the answer for me, Greg. So I'm going to ask you to take me home. Okay. You know, as directors, we're often trying to trust our instincts, but sometimes it's hard to find those instincts. And having come from the world of documentary, did you have any difficulty figuring out when you feel like you nailed the take, or when you feel like you had what you wanted? Or is that all coming from your experience in the past? Or can you talk a little bit about knowing when you have it?
I think in documentaries, you know what feels authentic and what doesn't, because you're directing real people and creating situations where real people are going to act natural in front of a camera, which is not a natural thing for most people. So yeah, I had pretty good instincts anyway about what's going to work and what doesn't, and when you have it, when you don't, you know, and when to stop. Just before we started, I talked to Matt Heineman, who directed Private War and, you know, done some amazing documentaries. So he had just made his first feature. It was finishing it as I was starting mine. And he said to me something, he said, just Greg, just trust your documentary instincts, because, you know, that's what I realized. We know what we're doing. And he was right. There's little technical things about, like, do you have the right coverage and all that kind of stuff, which I had a great crew on. And, you know, you have to learn knowing when something feels right, and knowing how to talk to actors, knowing when you got it, knowing how to stick to a schedule, all that stuff, I had a pretty good instinct on.
For the scene that we were talking about in the loom shop with the weaver, that was two cameras, I imagine, right?
Yes, we had two cameras. I think most of that is from one. We did a few takes, obviously.
Oh, you did a few takes. Oh, I was wondering, because like you talked about how the first take was so powerful that I saw that hug in the film, and I mean, that's where that's what really got me, you know, because it was such a raw moment. So I was imagining that you probably shot with two cameras, and you know, but you did do a couple of takes of it after.
But her performance, the main part, is the first, and that moment at the end when Wagner, you know, kind of doesn't know what to do at the end, and that's all the first take. And then obviously Wagner's amazing, so he's like, we gotta do that again, Wagner, we need to close up on you, like, as you hug her. And I mean, that's no problem for an actor like that. But I think we generally had two cameras. I think if we had two on that,
people, and you know, doing the documentary thing where you're getting like these real stories out of someone who isn't used to being on camera, to working with professional actors, like, was there a big learning curve for you there, or was that pretty easy to just like move over to doing this kind of work?
I mean I'd never worked with actors before. It was pretty straightforward. I had a great team, right? So we were very in tune. Like, my first AD was really attuned to actors' needs. My DP loves working with actors, and very tuned into their sort of emotional state. So with something like Sergio, where you have these really heightened, sort of deeply emotional scenes, trying to sort of schedule the day and manage the set so that it, you know, they can keep that, is really important. Those moments where she's going up to the rubble and talking to Sergio and finds out what happens to him, and those were all shot over 3 or 4 days.
Oh, wow.
Because we had to get the light, you know, consistent. And, that's very challenging for anybody. She's an incredible professional and technically just absolutely knocked it out of the park. But, you know, trying to, like, create a moment where you're not asking them to, like, hey, can you keep crying for, like, you know, 3 hours? We got to, like, really just adjust these little lights. It's like, you just got to get it. Tell them what's happening. Be clear. Like, if it's going to be an hour, let them know. You know, it's fine. The actors will do it. But you got to be like, don't tell them we're ready to go in 5 minutes. And then, oh, in fact, it's going to be another 45. You know, that's hard. The performance might suffer because of that. I mean, they can do it, but it's like, it's better for them to, like, to just know clearly what's going to be expected of them. It's not that different from documentaries, because you're managing real people. But it's obviously the scale and the depth of emotion is very different.
After doing this, and, you know, you've made, like, countless documentaries, the one narrative feature film, do you want to do this again? Are you excited to go out and make more narrative content?
I do want to do it again. I really liked it. I think, it's fun. You know, the scale of the stories that you can tell it's very attractive, just creatively. I also think that right now, in this moment, the kind of documentaries that I've been doing for the last 15, 20 years, I try not to make political documentaries, but they exist in this kind of political space. So, you know, the hunt for bin Laden, or, you know, the Obama administration this last year, and domestic terrorism. I've done all these sort of things. They're often now seen through a political lens because our public discourse is so divided. And it's very hard to then speak to people who kind of prejudge your film, either positively or negatively, depending on whether they, you know, where they fall politically. And I think that drama, narrative, still is a way of speaking to a wider group of people. We all sort of are drawn to stories. And I'm just trying to reach people. I have no interest in making films that appeal to a small niche of people who I already agree with. And, you know, right. I just try to, you know, and I want to just move people and get people to reflect on themselves and the world that we live in. And I think that right now, that drama is a more powerful way and a more effective way of doing that.
So this is sort of more of a documentary question. And I know that we have a lot of listeners who are documentary filmmakers or aspiring documentary filmmakers. And you've had a full career in documentary films. And it seems like you've probably only really been doing this directing as your main form of income for your career. Is that right? Are you like sustaining yourself off of your filmmaking?
I've been lucky, yes, for a number of years, yes.
So what advice would you give to other documentary filmmakers who are making their documentaries and having issues maybe like getting the next funding or, you know, actually making a self-sustaining career?
It's hard. I mean, being freelance is hard, and you never know where, you know, every film could be the last one day. I always tell myself one day, you know, one film will be the last. So you just don't know when that's going to come. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you have to wait a couple of years between projects. It's I've been there. From when I started directing films, to I was able to focus on projects I really cared about, was passionate about. And I think that comes across in the way that both the films were made, but also in the way that people, funders, kind of perceived the project. So there's no secret how to earn a living. I found a home a few different times. I had a great mentor in London, a producer, director, documentaries who had an amazing track record with the BBC and with US Public Television. He introduced me to the producers of Frontline, of PBS, and I made a number of films for Frontline over the years. And then from that was able to, you know, approach HBO and made my first feature documentary, which was Sergio. But each step of the way, what I did was I sort of surrounded myself with people who knew the world I wanted to get into better than I did, and helped kind of introduce me into that world. So, you know, when I made Sergio as a documentary, my producers were John Batsek and Julie Goldman, who I think between them have probably 4 or 5 Oscar nominations and wins
for
best documentary. And so, you know, they kind of, I had to convince them first, and they're like, they helped me figure out this next thing. And so it's surrounding yourself with people that probably know what you're trying to do better than you do, and learning from them, I guess, is probably the thing. And that plus finding projects you really are passionate about are the secret.
Well, we end every show with this, similarly how we start every show, which is just like a rapid fire round of a few final questions. What's the first film you've ever made? This could be a student film. This could be when you were 5 years old, whatever it was. First film you've ever made, and how do you feel about it now?
It was called The Red Car. It was me and my friend, who is now a successful Broadway producer, Craig Saavedra, and we took my dad's red Audi into the hills house in Southern California, and drove the hell out of it on these dirt roads and made a very bad action movie, but it was fun. And he didn't find out about it for like another 10 years.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
It was on an interview I heard with Francis Ford Coppola's daughter. What's her name?
Sophia.
Oh, Sophia Coppola.
Sophia Coppola, yes, exactly. She was talking about making Virgin Suicide. What was the first film she did?
It was, and it's the 20th anniversary, like this week, of Virgin Suicide.
Yes, okay. So someone was asking her, this was probably, like, somebody asked her what she learned. And she said, when she made her first film, her dad told her, you got to figure out one single emotion that the film is about, because everyone's going to come up to you with a million questions, like everything from like, what should the costumes be, to what should the background be, or what should be on this, what kind of wine should be on this table for this dinner scene, all of which is true, and have a single emotion that defines what the movie is about. And you can then use it to convey, to at least come up with an answer that makes sense and is consistent. And for that film, she decided on that loss was that one emotion. And that was really key for me, because I thought about what's the single emotion, and I hit on empathy. And everything in this movie, I just, whenever someone would say, what should this scene be like, I would just have that single emotion, and I would use it to kind of be able to answer those questions quickly, because people just want answers. They just want to know what to do and what kind of set to build and all that kind of stuff. I just thought about that single word. And so that was incredibly helpful.
That's the best answer to that question we've had so far, A. And B, I just did it for the film I'm in pre-pro on. And that like just now just helped me. So well done, Greg. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker? Like, are you trying to win an Oscar? Are you trying to play 300 theaters? Like, do you have a numeric goal?
No, I don't. I just want to make movies I believe in and want to spend, you know, 2-3 years of my life immersed in. So, no, I think, you know, in the documentary world, a lot of my friends, well, I love the doc filmmakers, but people are so obsessed with awards.
Yeah.
So obsessed with awards. It distorts the whole process. And everyone starts, you know, playing everyone else. And you get all these emails about how, you know, come see my movie. And it's all sort of, a lot of it's all a game. And it's kind of nauseating. And I mean, I'm a member of the Academy and all that, but I've not won an Oscar. And but sure, I would love to. But, you know, if you just play for that, it's not why any of us got into this. We are lucky to be making movies, incredibly lucky and privileged. And let's remember why we actually do it, which is to tell stories that move people, not to win awards.
Also a very good answer. If you could go back in time, what's one piece of advice you would give yourself?
Don't be afraid. You know, when I was in my 20s or something, I would have loved to direct and one day maybe direct a narrative feature. I mean, it took me a long time to realize that I could. Believe in yourself, but don't be too arrogant and go out and get the experience. Because the experience that I got in the real world, you know, was invaluable. Because when I finally came to making a movie, I wasn't referring, my references were not other movies, they were real world experiences that I had been lucky enough to be a part of.
Is making movies hard?
Is it hard?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is hard. But, you know, it's also an amazing job and it's just a movie. And so it's useful to keep it in perspective and that anybody who's making a movie, no matter what size, is an incredible privilege to be able to explore the human condition. And it's such a personal, visceral, intimate way that can touch an audience. So, you know, never lose sight of that. But yeah, of course, it's hard work, but anything worth doing is hard.
Is there anywhere that people should go if they want to learn more about your films?
Yeah, I mean, I think Netflix, watch Sergio, watch the kind of the shot by shot thing that Wagner Moore and I did for Sergio. I do have a website. I have a Twitter, which is GJ Barker. I've got an Instagram, which is just Greg Barker, where we have a lot of behind the scenes photos. And we've just started posting a series of interviews I did with a lot of our key production crew, from the DP, costume, sound designer. There's not a lot out there if you're directing your first movie of, you know, beyond film school. So I've spent a lot of time just talking to the people who helped me make it about how we did it, from the writer and sound designer and all that. And it was incredible. So that'll be a resource out there that I hope people, you know, who are, you know, starting out can draw on as we go forward. It'll be through my Instagram.
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure to have links to that and the shot by shot and everything else in the show notes so people can find it. Because, I mean, that's what we're all about, is like the tools and passing on resources and, you know, kind of lifting the curtain up a little bit.
Yes.
So people can see how things are actually done. And, you know, I did something similar on my first feature. I did, like, it wasn't interviews with all the crew, but it was daily logs of my experiences.
Oh, that's
cool. Making the film. And, you know, it was kind of painful to listen to them later, but
right.
I think people have found them helpful. So that was nice. But
That's cool.
thanks for doing that. And I hope you continue to do that on your next project, because I think, yeah, this is the kind of thing that people are really hungry for and I think is really helpful in helping people learn, you know.
Great. Yeah, good. I think so. And also, you know, people, often directors are interviewed and actors, and it just seems like the movie just kind of happened. And as we all know, part of the pleasure of the process is it's so collaborative. And you have to know who those people are, what they do, and also honor their work.
Now it is time for the game. So, if this is the first time listening to the show, The Game is a segment that our wonderful producer, Eric Toms, came up with, where he asks us like an indie filmmaking challenge, a question, a quagmire, a scenario, like something that we have to solve. Like this disaster happens in this part of your process of making a movie, and what do you do? So, we don't get to read these ahead of time. We don't get any kind of, you know, prep at all. Liz is going to answer the question this week. And without any further delay, here is the game question of the week. You've completed your first indie film. Hooray! You had a moderate run in the film festival circuit and have found a distributor. Since it's your first time with film distribution, you find yourself in the dark and discover a lot of blind spots, one of which is that a distribution company really hasn't publicized your film. You're terrified that your film won't make any money because no one will be able to find it. To make things worse, the distribution company has changed the poster art to, in your opinion, something more cookie cutter and far less interesting. With only a few weeks to act, do you A, wait patiently and hope that your word of mouth gets eyes on your project, B, threaten the distribution company in hopes that they'll give your project more attention, C, set a fire, and when people start filming The Blaze, you scream, "My film can be seen on the following streamers." Other, what do you do, director? What do you do?
This is amazing. This is every indie filmmaker's situation who works with a traditional all rights distributor. Many distributors do not spend meaningful money or time marketing indie titles. So I would say just point one is that filmmakers should know that this is not an abnormal situation to be in, to have a distributor that does not publicize their film. Second thing is, yeah, they can change the artwork without telling you unless you negotiate in advance to have meaningful input on the marketing materials. So again, this is not that abnormal. Sorry, I'm a nerd. This is all I talk about all day. And I could go off on some sort of like soapbox on this, but I'll try not to. The answer is D, because the answer is you should be marketing your film in association with the distributor. You should not assume they are going to be marketing it. And you should be doing activations. You should be talking to your network. You should talk about it on your newsletter. You could be doing events. You could put on community screenings. There's lots of things that you could be doing. And you should just assume that the distributor is going to be doing nothing. And you can encourage them to do whatever they can, but you should be doing the bulk of the work. I just wanted to give one piece of advice. There's a lot of good reasons to turn your films into case studies, like, you know, being really transparent about how you make a movie or how much you make about a movie, or, you know, talking freely about movie making. But another good reason is it may get the distributor to act more, because they know that their efforts are going to be documented in a case study that's going to be available to the public and most likely of interest to indie filmmakers. So you could always say to your distributor, like, "Hey, I'm pitching an article to Filmmaker or Movie Maker Magazine." And I wouldn't lie, like, you should pitch an article to Movie Maker or Filmmaker Magazine. And you should document the efforts of yourself and your distributor. And you should say, "Hey, can you just let me know exactly what you'll be doing for marketing so I can just be super transparent about it?" And I'm sure they want to look good too, right? So if you really want to set a fire under your teammates' butts, let them know that you will be transparent. Transparency helps. Arik, what about you?
But don't set an actual fire, though, right?
You don't actually set a fire. I did very much enjoy Eric's option C.
What's an activation, just for those who don't know?
No, just like, I'm speaking vaguely, but it's like, if you were to do, like, I've done fundraisers, I've done comedy shows, I've done spin-a-thons. I've kind of mentioned this in the past. Just like, if you were to do some sort of public event to celebrate your film and draw eyeballs to it.
Nice. Yeah. Well, what would I do? I would definitely do B. None of these other options are good. I would talk to the distributor and like you said, like, figure out what their marketing plan is, because if they're a decent distributor, they'll be very clear and they'll tell you what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. And then you can reach out to that PR company and, like, you know, offer your services of, like, what can I do to help? What
if they have one, if they are working with a PR, just acknowledge that, right? Many sure. Distributors do not.
Yeah, I was lucky. Mine did. So I had a PR team that I got to work with, which was cool. But yeah, I mean, and I kind of feel like, for a distributor, like, that's sort of like, before I would sign, I'd be like, is there going to be a PR company? Because if the answer is no, then I'll probably go to somewhere else, because that's not good. But yeah, no, I would definitely, yeah, reach out to them and figure out what their plans are, if any. And if they don't have any plans, I would see if I could hire my own PR company to do it with me, because I don't want to do it by myself. I think doing it by myself is the worst idea. And I mean, like, in my experience, like, my team is not going to do it with me. I mean, maybe, but, like, not my specific team. It's because it's not their strong suits, and because they have other things they're doing, you know? So I think, yeah, I would definitely want to hire my own PR company. They didn't have one, and I would just work hand in hand with them, and I would do, you know, whatever I could to help get the movie out there. I think trying to attack, you know, YouTube channels to get them to take your trailer on and, like, you know, reach people that way, I think is a really good idea. We got like 180,000 hits on our trailer from one single website. And then we were on like
seven or eight YouTube channels, you know, but like that one like blew up, you know? And so I feel like that's what was really cool for me, just personally, just to like see everyone reacting to the movie, seeing the comments, and then like, you know, trying to capitalize on those views into rentals is really hard. But I know at least some of those people actually did watch the movie. So, you know, but anyways, that's what I would do. I would try to make it a partnership. I would not wait for them to do it by themselves. I would not come at them with aggression, you know, like it worked together. Like, you know, they want the same things that you want, but you just want it more than they do. So you just got to figure out how you can work together and get your movie out there. What do you guys think? Would you threaten your distributor? Have you threatened your distributor? I know people have definitely threatened distributors before. That's not an unheard of thing. Let us know. Send us a comment, question, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you like the show and really like it, I mean, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, which would be amazing. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimer, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for doing our social media. And big, big thanks to our producer, Eric Thomas, for being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to y'all next week.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.